Good morning, all. Calling this meeting to order. We have minutes from February 27th. Representative Long, would you move approval of the minutes?
So move.
Minutes are before you, members. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. And now we have House File 1405, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 1405 be returned to the Committee on Ways and Means with the recommendation that it be re-referred from there to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development.
Thank you for that, Representative Stevenson. He moves House File 1405, and he has a DE amendment, coded DE1.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the DE one, this amendment substitutes into the bill the language that passed off of the House floor last year, the Clean Energy First language that passed off the House floor last year, along with a few other additions that I will discuss in my remarks later.
DE one is before you, members. All those in. Oh, Representative Stasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just because the amendment is, you know, fairly fresh, but was there a fiscal note attached with it or requested, or is there a need for one before we adopt?
The author will respond.
Madam Chair, Representative Stasinski, a fiscal note has been requested on the DE amendment. There was a fiscal note last year on the governor's energy bill that had a $0 cost, and as I mentioned a minute ago, the overwhelming majority of this amendment is consistent with the language that passed off the House floor, so it had a $0 fiscal note. We are asking for a fiscal note on this bill. It will be heard, as I mentioned in my motion, in the Jobs Committee. That's important because there was a fiscal note on a Senate version of the bill that did have a $40,000 cost to deed. So we will be going to the Jobs Committee, and of course, if that fiscal note has unexpected result, we could always return to this committee.
Members, the DE1 is before you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, I believe you have an author's amendment.
I do also have an author's amendment. This just makes a couple of small changes to get the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to consider it. A couple of things that were in the House language last year that needed to be modified because we aren't taking the whole of the House energy bill.
I see no questions. Members, A15 is before you. It's the author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The A15 is adopted. Representative Stevenson, let's hear about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Members of the committee, the clean energy revolution is well underway, and while that revolution has been sparked and guided by policy like Minnesota's Next Generation Act, today the primary driver of that revolution is economic. The price of wind and solar are low and dropping. Great statistic over the summer that I heard from Michael Noble that the cost of those resources is dropping by over 1% a month. Can you think of anything else in the world that's dropping by almost 20% a year in cost? In Minnesota, we're blessed to have great corporate citizens like Xcel, co-ops like Conexus, 3M, Best Buy, all are very committed to seeing a clean energy future for Minnesota. And we are very lucky to have those great corporate citizens that are leading the charge. Our state's energy portfolio is changing rapidly as a result of those pressures. And this bill that's before you today is an effort to manage that transition, to smooth and speed the transition from our fossil fuel energy economy to a carbon-free energy sector. It refocuses our state's energy policy on three primary values: carbon reduction, affordability, and reliability. It also tries to mitigate some of the rough patches in the transition by addressing issues like host community transition. Clean Energy First isn't an ideological bill, it's a practical bill that's the result of months and months of stakeholder conversations, and I want to particularly thank my collaborator and co-author in the Senate on this bill, Senator Senjum, who's been a wonderful advocate for this bill. But you can see the breadth of involvement with the people who are sitting with me at the table today, ranging from the utilities, labor, and the environmental community. As I mentioned at the outset, the bill that's before the committee should be very familiar to members of the committee because with modest additions, this is the same language that passed through this committee last year and passed off the floor of the House. So what's in it? First of all, we have an emphasis on local job creation. It's very important that the energy infrastructure of tomorrow be built by good paying jobs here in Minnesota, just like our last generation of energy infrastructure was built. A focus on transmission planning and ensuring that we have the adequate transition resources we need to have this transition occur quickly. Focusing on the host communities, as I mentioned earlier, and addressing the consequences that impact those communities that are facing large facility closures. And then the heart and soul of this bill is the rewrite of the existing preference for renewable energy that has been in Minnesota law since the early 90s. We want to, first of all, up the standard of review that the Public Utilities Commission is using on that question to a clear and convincing standard. But we also want to refocus on those three values I mentioned earlier: carbon reduction, affordability, and reliability. Those are the things that we think should be driving our energy decisions in Minnesota. So all of that was in the bill last year. What's new this year? We had a hearing a couple weeks ago on my seasonal dispatch bill, which I like to call the coal holiday bill. That has been included. Last year's bill had a prevailing wage requirement for large wind products. This expands that requirement to all large energy products projects. As I mentioned earlier, it's very important to me that the next generation of energy infrastructure in Minnesota be built with high-quality, high-paying jobs. And last, there's a new provision that actually is inspired by a bill that Representative Zelensky authored relating to lighting on top of windmill structures and trying to be good neighbors to our friends in communities that are going to have be host to large wind farms. And in conclusion, what I'd say is most of the statutory framework that guides our energy policy in Minnesota is 15 to 30 years old. The renewable energy preference, as I mentioned, has been in law since 1993. It's an understatement to say that the energy landscape has changed pretty dramatically in those 15 years, let alone 30 years. And it's time for us to refresh our law to better meet the reality that we are facing today and take meaningful action to address the climate crisis. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have some testifiers sitting with me today, and I'd like to first turn it over to Mike Bull from the Center for Energy and the Environment.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Bull. I'm the policy director for the Center for Energy and Environment. And I think Representative Stevenson gave a terrific overview, of much of which I may reiterate. So as I we did not necessarily coordinate our testimony. We appreciate the opportunity to urge your support for House File 1405, Clean Energy First, and are thankful for the great work that Representative Stevenson, Representative Long, you, Madam Chair, and others have put into this bill over the past year. Clean Energy First started a couple of years ago in conversations I was having with Beth Soholt from Clean Grid Alliance and Paul Austin from Conservation Minnesota to identify and start to address some of the critical items that might slow the clean energy transition in Minnesota, a potential rush to natural gas as Minnesota power plants retire, a lack of coordination for addressing community and worker needs as those plants retire, the need for significant additional transmission planning and investment, and the need for our friends in labor to see benefit from this clean energy transition and not just pain. And we were very grateful when Governor Walz added this initiative to his to be part of his One Minnesota Path to Clean Electricity package last year. As Representative Stevenson said in his overview, Clean Energy First updates and broadens the current renewable preference enacted in 1993 and is built around a very simple concept that whenever an electric utility needs additional generation, whether that's because of increased customer demand, power plant retirements, or the expiration of power purchase agreements, the utility would look first to clean energy resources to fill that need. Renewable energy, energy efficiency, demand response, and energy storage. If the Minnesota PUC finds that the utility can satisfy its resource need reliably and affordably through these clean energy resources, it would direct the utility to move forward with those. However, if the utility can demonstrate that a combination of clean energy resources would not meet that resource need reliably and affordably, it can look to non-renewable resources like natural gas generation. And under the House bill, the utility must make that demonstration by clear and convincing evidence, as Representative Stevenson mentioned, and I think that's important. Over time, this ratcheting effect of implementing clean energy resources whenever possible will lead to an increasingly clean and ultimately decarbonized electricity supply to serve Minnesotans. As I mentioned earlier, and as Representative Stevenson also mentioned, the bill addresses a number of critical areas of clean energy transition. Begins to address the fact that we aren't going to be able to meet our clean energy needs with the transmission infrastructure that we have. And so we need concentrated, collaborative planning to identify the transmission system we need and to build that system. In addition, Clean Energy First would direct some focused attention on the needs of the communities that host these large power plants that will eventually be retired and replaced, and the workers that make their living there. CEE released a study last week by my colleagues Audrey Partridge and Brady Steigauf that provides significant insight into these issues by giving voice to folks who will be directly impacted by future power plant retirements. I think there's a copy of that study in your packet today. It's terrific. It's a great read. And also, this is a good spot to highlight a bill by Representative Christensen that's in Representative Mahoney's committee that would provide some real resources in addition to the coordinated planning that we have in Clean Energy First. And then finally, it's important that local workers benefit from this clean energy transition under groundbreaking, maybe nation-leading language negotiated between Clean Gooder Alliance and the LIUNA Union. Our utilities and the Minnesota PUC would consider local job impacts and give preference to resource plans and projects that maximize employment and career opportunities for local workers. Kevin Prentice, my colleague, will highlight that. And Madam Chair, we support the bill that's before you as a pragmatic and progressive approach to Minnesota's clean energy transition. That said, there's a couple of items that we want to work with you and Representative Stevenson and others on the bill as it moves forward. One, I think it's important that the bill better reflect the significant value of Minnesota's existing nuclear plants in meeting the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals. There's a sentence on page 4. Lines 23 and 24 of the DE amendment that excludes Minnesota's existing nuclear fleet from the definition of carbon-free resources. I think that exclusion may be counterproductive, and we'd like to talk with folks about that. And two, we agreed to a provision last week in the Senate to give communities on the Iron Range comfort that Minnesota Power's generation facilities wouldn't be retired early without robust analysis and evaluation of the costs and savings from early retirement. An analysis I said in the Senate, and I'll say here today, that I'm absolutely confident the PUC would require without that provision. But these range communities have already absorbed the retirement of 11 of the 13 coal plants that exist on the range. Minnesota Power has been in a rapid clean energy transition of its fleet. And they've absorbed, the range has absorbed the job loss and the tax base that goes on along with those retirements. And there's quite a bit of anxiety all across the Iron Range about additional retirements. And so we support giving them that comfort. And with that, Madam Chair, thank you again for the hearing today. And I'm happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my next testifier is Greg Ritterbusch, CEO of Kinexus Energy.
Madam Chair, representatives, I'm Greg Ritterbusch, President and CEO of Kinexus Energy. Kinexus is the largest electric distribution cooperative, one of the largest in the country. We serve 136,000 members throughout the North Metro. 12 state senators and 20 state representatives have constituents served by Kinexus, and we're honored to be invited by one of those today, which is Representative Stevenson. Our wholesale power provider is Great River Energy, and we are their largest owner. Kinexus Energy is in support of the Clean Energy First legislative initiative. While I'm aware details remain under discussion, we're supportive of both the House and Senate and encourage your work towards a successful outcome. Clean Energy First's big picture benefits line up with Kinexus member consumer priorities. As a customer-owned utility, every day, Kinexus leadership and staff have absolute clarity of mission serving our members. And our members' highest priority is reliability and affordability. And when we ask about greening the grid, in our 2019 survey, 83% said they were supportive of the environmental commitment that Kinexus is making, but with a caveat, green, no-carbon electricity is good, as long as retail electricity rates do not increase because of it. And today, we can do that. But clean energy's first fundamental point is clean resources are to be added unless it can be shown they cannot meet the need affordably or reliably. We're very aware of clean energy resource pricing. Solar and wind energy at scale are less expensive, as briefed by Representative Stevenson, than our legacy wholesale power supply costs today. We have supported Great River Energy, adding wind resources, and Kinexus has been adding solar resources. They are affordable, and the grid has remained reliable as ably operated by MISO, utilities, and related parties. Briefly, three topics that are important to Kinexus as we look at these ideas. First, mandates. We are in a clean energy transition, and as the grid approaches higher levels of renewables, we need to retain flexibility. So we need to avoid staged mandates as all parties work successfully integrating clean energy onto the grid. Transmission. There's mention in this legislation of a transmission study, and the idea of doing that to enable the modern grid with ever-increasing renewable resources is fundamental. It's the right thing to do. But beyond the study, in future years, please be prepared to consider and facilitate significant growth in Minnesota and regional transmission investment, cost recovery, and siting. And with respect to renewable asset siting itself, renewable technology is continuing to evolve, but acceptably siting these assets, which will impact land utilization, must be concurrently considered. All of us, everyone here wants clean energy, but local considerations and benefits are important. NIMBY is real, but we find it to be addressable. So the devil's in the details. I am not naive or Pollyanna about the challenges that you have to reach an agreement across the legislature, but my testimony today supports and encourages clean energy first. If we, with the big W, work together, it can get done. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, my next testifier is Kevin Pranis from La Una.
Thank you. My name is Kevin Pranis, and I'm here today on behalf of La Una, Minnesota, North Dakota, a union of more than 12,000 proud construction laborers who build and maintain our state's transportation, water, energy, and building infrastructure, along with our building trades brothers and sisters. I want to begin by thanking the Chair, Vice Chair, and Representative Stevenson for the opportunity to voice our support for House File 1405, the Clean Energy First Bill. I also want to express our thanks for the committee's willingness to pursue bipartisan energy solutions. We were disappointed to come up short last session despite your hard work. We want you to know that we're now seeing efforts on both sides bear fruit in the form of a companion bill that was voted out of the Senate Energy Committee last week that we support. La Una members support Clean Energy First because we believe it provides a framework for clean energy progress and upholds the core values and preserves the public benefits of regulated utilities and the regulatory process that have delivered to generations of Minnesotans affordable, safe, and reliable service, high-quality jobs and economic opportunity, and steady environmental progress that has made Minnesota a leader. We care a great deal about energy. For decades, our members have worked alongside building trades brothers and sisters to construct and safely maintain Minnesota's fleet of conventional and nuclear power plants, and a growing number of members are employed in the solar and wind industry. If you want to know what jobs building, operating, and maintaining coal and nuclear plants have meant to our members and other Minnesota workers, we encourage everyone to read the excellent report that Mike's organization, Center for Energy and the Environment, put together that talks about how much those jobs mean and how much those plants mean to those communities. We're committed to a clean energy transition and other measures that are needed to address climate change, and committed to make sure that energy continues to create high-quality, family-supporting jobs for Minnesotans. We come at this with a simple principle. Clean energy jobs should be just as good and just as available to local workers as jobs in conventional and nuclear energy that have supported generations of Minnesotans and their families. We've heard climate change compared to a house that's on fire. If that's the case, then Clean Energy First is the Bucket Brigade, a plan to all pull together to make clean energy progress as quickly as we can one bucket, one regulatory decision at a time, one resource decision at a time, as quickly as we can move. We understand that a lot of folks would rather have a big shiny fire engine to put out the fire, and we don't disagree. But we also don't think we can afford to wait for that fire engine to arrive to start trying to put out the fire. We also don't think we can wait to address obstacles that are currently preventing Minnesota workers and communities from fully participating in the benefits of energy development. We've already lost thousands of jobs that could have benefited local communities and ratepayers that instead went to out-of-state workers on renewable energy projects because of a failure to plan and consider local workers within the process. We can't afford to lose any more, and that's why the bill includes consideration for local jobs in utility resource planning and decision making that we think will fundamentally change where those benefits go. We're also losing more jobs due to lack of transmission with projects that we could be building but can't because there's not enough transmission, and we can't afford to keep losing those jobs or those projects either. And obviously, we and other trades are facing job losses at coal plants as they shut down, and I think as the study highlights, it's important that we support those communities in their transition. Finally, we want to thank Representative Stevenson for including prevailing wage protections within the House version of the bill. I think prevailing wage is a sensible policy that actually fits what the market does. Responsible developers and contractors are consistently, this year, last year, paying prevailing wage to local workers. That helps provide a floor and helps provide some certainty that local workers and that the work will be safe. I just want to highlight that only a couple of months ago, a temporary worker was buried alive trying to rescue one of his coworkers on a wind project in Washington State. That's not clean energy when it involves workers' blood to get it done. Prevailing wage helps set a standard that ensures that people have the proper training and safety and that those jobs benefit local workers. And we think that it's entirely feasible in this industry and appreciate that effort. And we would like to reinforce the hard work that's been done in the Senate. We know that there are differences in policy and understand that, but we think that the Senate has been very serious in its consideration. We support the work that was done to provide some reassurance to folks at Boswell, which we think was a reasonable compromise and a lot of hard work there, and also hope that the House will consider the broadest set of energy tools that we can look at, including looking potentially at carbon capture. I know some of you were at a forum last evening that had a lot of interesting information, and whatever you believe about where it might be appropriate, I don't think there should be any question that carbon capture has to be part of that solution. We encourage its consideration in this bill.
Madam Chair, my last testifier is Jessica Trish from the Sierra Club.
Hi, thank you, Chair Wagenius, committee members, and Representative Stevenson, and the rest of the panelists. My name is Jessica Trish. I am a senior campaign representative with the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal to Clean Energy campaign. The Sierra Club represents over 80,000 members and supporters in Minnesota, empowered to protect communities by addressing our state's most urgent environmental issues. As you may know, Sierra Club has been very critical of the Senate's version of Clean Energy First. We don't think that it lives up to its name. So I'm very happy to be here today to speak in support of this bill that does. The concept of Clean Energy First is common sense. To address the climate crisis, to protect communities from pollution, and to create good, family-sustaining clean energy jobs in Minnesota, utilities should be prioritizing clean energy and looking to fossil fuels as a last resort. Our state is transitioning away from coal, and as that happens, it's critical that we meet new and replacement energy needs with renewable energy and energy savings, and not fracked gas that's risky for our climate and for customers. We won't be able to meet Minnesota's climate goals if we continue to replace coal plants with gas plants. If you look at the life cycle emissions of gas from the extraction to the transportation and burning at the plant, the climate impact is very significant. It's comparable to coal. And as this committee knows, we need to be moving away from fossil fuels and to 100% clean energy. Investments of new gas is also an economic risk. Last year, Rocky Mountain Institute did a study showing clean energy portfolios could outcompete gas plants, new proposed gas plants, 90% of the time. Clean Energy First can help us stop that rush to gas while supporting communities transitioning away from coal and supporting local clean energy jobs in our state. But the specifics are important to make sure that the policy's outcome matches its intent. We think there are some key components of this bill that support a clean energy transition and set it apart from its Senate counterpart. So I'm going to highlight a few. The first one, it puts clean energy first. It prioritizes and incentivizes clean energy as defined as renewable energy like wind and solar, energy storage, energy efficiency, and demand management. does not include, as clean energy, coal or gas plants with carbon capture technology that only captures a portion of the carbon and then uses it to push more oil out of the ground, or garbage incineration, or nuclear. All are included in the preference in the Senate bill. This bill also strengthens the existing statute for clean energy preference, as others have mentioned, not only by the definition of clean energy, but by requiring utilities to show that they cannot meet new needs reliably or affordably with clean energy before moving to fossil fuel generation. And it does not weaken the current preference by adding consideration for existing fossil fuel plants or building new fracked gas plants. This bill applies to all new and replacement electricity needs for Minnesota power or for Minnesota customers, all Minnesota customers. It doesn't have any loopholes for gas plants that have already been proposed in the state and will still go in front of Minnesota regulators, such as Xcel's proposed Sherco gas plant and Minnesota Power's proposed NTEC gas plant Superior. And it doesn't contain any loopholes to allow utilities to propose fossil fuel plants out of state. Finally, it supports local clean Minnesota clean energy jobs by creating a preference for local job creation and requiring prevailing wage for large solar and wind projects, and it provides planning support for communities transitioning away from coal. If done well, Clean Energy First can help move our state towards 100% clean energy, can help us avoid building risky, new, unnecessary gas plants. Again, we are very excited to speak in support of this House bill today and thank everyone for your time.
Madam Chair, now I would stand open for any questions of the committee for myself or for the testifiers.
Representative Long has the first question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was able to attend the carbon capture event last night and found it really interesting. My question is for Mr. Ritterbusch in that regard. There was a lot of conversation last night about the costs of carbon capture and sequestration, and one of the amendments today deals with that. It tries to define as clean energy 80% capture, which I think has its own problems because we're admitting that there's 20% that is not captured. But I'm just curious if your utility has looked into the pricing of carbon capture and how that compares to things like wind and solar and storage.
Representative and Madam Chair, I also found the meetings last night quite timely and well done by all the speakers, and there were really three points that got affirmed for me. I'll cover the economic one second. With respect to the technology itself, it's been under development for a long time, about 20 years. We heard good progress being made, heard applications that are outside of generation, like the capture of CO2 from ethanol, and we have a very important ethanol industry in this state that carbon capture might be a valuable tool for. So it does seem that we're on a path to have carbon capture and storage as a tool that could be used. Second, on the economics, and I will comment with respect to power, they're not competitive today with wind and solar on an energy basis. And I'll just paint one quick picture of that. A coal plant, a legacy coal plant, typical one might have economics around $48 a megawatt hour. Compare that to wind deals that are in the 20s, all right? Solar, maybe a little north of that. But carbon capture and storage takes 20% of the electricity to do the separation and pressurization to put it underground or move it on for EOR. If you had an asset performing at $48, and you lost 20% of what you produced, now that asset is at $60 per megawatt hour. It was already struggling to be competitive at 48. It didn't help for it to be 60 when you put that on. And I'm setting aside 45Q might be able to provide all the capital for it, perhaps, and I'm not even adding operating costs. So that's the economic impact of storage, carbon capture and storage today. The last thing I'd say, though, is we need to think together that society is playing the long game to 2050, right? And getting up to 50%, most people can see readily to that using conventional resources. 80%, probably. EPRI, Xcel, and others are saying that last 20 is really hard. We might need other tools.
So the thing that needs to be thought about carefully is whether eliminating it from the tool set now is the right thing to do. Okay, it's something that's going to require some careful debate and conversation. But what is true is even if it was in the legislation as a tool today, a plant on carbon capture and storage is decidedly more expensive than adding solar or wind. I hope that addressed your question.
Representative Swasensky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of a general question. I have a district that does border South Dakota. So when the test fair talked about local jobs, what does that mean?
So that was exactly designed. I mean, a lot of, as you probably know, a lot of the wind development has been on the South Dakota border, on the Iowa border, and we have members of our Minneapolis local who live in South Dakota just across the border. And so the way that this was defined for legislation and the way it's is residents of the state of Minnesota, residents of the utility service territory, which in some case may go into North Dakota or maybe smaller, larger, and anyone within 150 miles of the project. And 150 miles is basically commuting. It's a very long commute. It's not unheard of for construction workers, but not very many people can commute more than that every day, go home and sleep in their own bed. And so the idea is if you're going home sleeping in your own bed, you're also shopping in that local area. So you might live across the border, but you contribute more to the local economy than somebody from Duluth, right? So it's designed to really be for local, you know, for Minnesotans, but really for local workers, including everybody within the area of that project.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is to Mr. Ritterbush again from Conexus. Thank you for the tour earlier this summer of the battery storage plant. What an impressive thing that was that I was able to attend. I know many other members did too. As the largest kind of the mega co-op in the state, we know that you're, I feel on this committee, I bring up the munis and the co-ops quite a bit. And we're trying to keep you separated a bit from some of the public utilities just because, again, of the different model and such. There's a piece, and you said it very well earlier today, that your members made a clear message to you is that let's do all the renewable we can, but you can't raise our price. And I'm generalizing. I know that's not exactly what you said. But we are struggling here, and you're one of the biggest providers, owners of GRE. There's a lot of interest in what you're doing and how you're doing it. Are you concerned that a part of this bill today that's been presented, and I know you said the devil's in the details, we need to work through this, but I get a skip and a little heartburn when our largest co-op that I keep fighting for here at this table is sort of all in on a bill that is suggesting in a section here that it wants to make state policy where we're favoring electricity resources with non-renewable sources. Does that give you some concern down the road? Does that give you some, from the PUC standpoint, how are we going to address that if we eventually make this our state long-range plan of getting rid of everything except renewable energy distribution? So from your standpoint, from your perch, I'm just curious how you see that and how I can help be a better player with the co-op world on this table.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Baker, I'll comment a bit on it, but please know that that we have a wholesale power provider that certainly works to sort these issues out, which is Great River Energy and others of that. I say the thing that is key to this bill is it says if you add a resource, it has to be reliable and affordable. And when you put that screen to today's options, they do end up being the renewable ones that are solar and of course wind, and then maybe batteries to help leverage those resources, although batteries themselves aren't inherently renewable. But the one caution that I gave, which is I would ask the representatives and the senators to think hard about the tool set that you leave available to be used. And it might very well be that when we think cross-sector, which is the new thing, right, we can't focus only on generation or only on transportation. Think cross-sector. And the movement of carbon around, we very likely may need other tools. So carbon capture and storage might be a tool that allows an overall lower level of CO2 on the long haul. So I would encourage, as the point's been made, our past legislation is now decades old, and it set forth a framework that's gotten us to today. Let's think about this legislation setting forth framework for the next couple decades, and be careful that we don't take out some of the tools that we might need, even though in the near term it does appear that the solutions to 50%, perhaps as high as 80, are substantially renewable.
That, Madam Chair, that answers it, and I appreciate your caution to some of these tools in the toolbox to not remove them. And I think we'll be talking about more about some of these components in the bill today, because again, we need to make sure that whatever that is, your company is going to be directed by the policies that we set here, ultimately delivered through the PUC or others, because you're still a co-op member, but it all is sort of generated from the PUC and what the language is here. So thank you for that overview and your clarity on that. So thank you very much.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for Mr. Ritterbusch again. I guess we all just wanted to hear from you today. I was interested in hearing about your support for the research needed for transmission. And I just wanted to understand a little bit more about where Conexus is right now. I know this past summer Xcel has begun the process of expanding and increasing and improving the older transmission lines, and there's a big cost to that, which will affect rates. But my question for you is, where right now, Conexus, where do you see the transmission availability as far as how much load can you bear now, or how much are you using now? How expandable is it in terms of what capacity level are you at right now versus what we're going to need in the near-term future if we decide to go carbon-free?
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you for that. There's a lot to that question, of course. If you measure by the performance of the grid today, investor-owned and customer-owned municipals and cooperatives are well-served. Minnesotans have enjoyed extremely high reliability, and that's indicative that the superhighway that moves bulk electricity around is up and functioning successfully. All right, so that is the state of the grid. But again, we're playing the long game, and resources like wind are not necessarily available economically in areas this part of the Twin Cities and things like that. They're going to be in North Dakota or in southwestern Minnesota. So the interstate highway system, if you let me make that analogy, needs to be expanded to enable those resources to come into the grid and be able to move that energy to market. We know the need is there already because, without getting into too detailed, as new projects are seeking to interconnect on the transmission grid, the prices of those interconnections are becoming higher and higher because it's difficult because of congestion. So the idea in the House legislation to study it and it is directing, indicating MISO to do that. They are the organizer of transmission reliability in this entire region. Is a phenomenal idea to do, and then be ready for the outcome of that. Because the expectation by the practitioners, those that own the assets, is there is a need. The CapEx 2020, which built a nice increment to the infrastructure in the state, those roads are pretty well filled today. And the market will continue to operate well, but the next roads need to be planned. And I hope that's an answer that addresses your question.
Yeah, I thank you very much.
I don't see any other questions, so now it's time for public comment. Thank you all so much for testifying. And with the public comment, we'll start with Stacy Fucci from Great River Energy, and the next person will be Bradley Peterson.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Stacey Fujii, and I'm with Great River Energy. So just as an overview, we have some concerns with this bill as it is presented to us right now. Overall, we think that the bill adds a level of complexity and uncertainty to resource planning going forward. We would say that the bill needs to acknowledge and understand the fact that we are in a MISO market. You've heard that with the previous testifiers. So as utilities, we interact daily with the MISO market. All load-serving entities in Minnesota purchase all of their energy requirements from the MISO market. As my general counsel would say, the market is the market. It is neither clean nor non-renewable nor carbon-free, or it is all those things at the same time. So we need to figure out within the context of resource planning, how do we account for those things? Second, we would like to make sure we've got some clarity as it relates to our peaking plants. So again, technology will take us in a forward, but in the immediate future, in the short term, we need to be able to know how we account for our peaking plants, because peaking plants in and of themselves only run or only called upon by MISO to run when it's economic to do so. And so we just need to figure out how that works within resource planning. Third, is there's been some discussion, carbon capture and sequestration. It is a technology, it is not a renewable technology, but certainly when it is fully deployed, it would be able to assist in reducing the emissions of existing coal-fired power plants. And as Mr. Ritterbush pointed out, we would like to have all the tools on the table to continue to look at those things, if it's economic, if it's part of what we think our members can need and can finance. Finally, with respect to transmission planning, so there's language starting at lines 11.5 about studying transmission needs as it relates to retiring of generation. So what our transmission folks would say is, we don't know where generation is going to be located. Just because a generation plant is retired does not mean that a new generation will be sited at that location. It could be other places. So the complexity of figuring out where generation is going to be located and what transmission needs are going to be necessary would require a lot of research. It may also require us to look at cross-utility transmission needs, and in the scope of a single utilities resource plan, that may be confusing and it may add some complexity. But overall, you know, we would like to continue to work with Representative Stevenson to talk about some of these issues going forward, things that we need to do to understand more what is requested of us so that we provide meaningful information within our resource plan. And to Mr. Ritterbush's point, we don't want to lose our flexibility. We want to be able to provide, and we think we can do it quite nimbly as a cooperative, to get our members, respond to our members' needs, to respond to changing technology, to respond to market changes. And so that's the end of my testimony. If you have any questions, please let me know.
Yes. Representative Proffel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Fuji, thank you for your testimony. A question I genuinely don't know the answer to is that right now with the bill as this is set up, how would that handle those MISO purchases you talk about in the real-time market where, you know, we don't, the electrons don't have different color codes on them. How does this bill address that issue as it's currently written?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, that's the question that we have. We're not really sure. We don't know how those interactions are being accounted for within the bill. That's something we need some clarity on.
Madam Chair, would it be possible for either the author or one of the advocates of the bill to address that question? I have to step out for a meeting, and I'd like to know that whether Representative Stevenson knows or one of the previous testifiers. I know it's a more technical and integrated question, but whatever, just to get an answer from what the bill as it's written right now, how it currently would handle those purchases.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I'll take a stab at it, and then I'll invite Mr. Bull to come forward and correct all the errors that I make. It's important to understand that Clean Energy First, as a primary vector, focuses on the sourcing of new energy resources, right? So we're talking principally about construction of new facilities and modifications or restructuring of existing facilities when there's substantial new investment. There is language in the bill about power purchase agreements, buying from one source to another. I don't know, and maybe Mr. Bull can clarify whether that would relate to a purchase from MISO that Great River Energy might, but I think it's important to understand what we're talking about here generally is the construction of new resources. And with that, I guess I defer to Mr. Bull.
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, Representative Garofalo, I think that it's a point that's worthy of discussion. The proposal, Clean Energy First, was designed around how the utilities should be planning for to meet their resource need, and not necessarily regulating those particular short-term. We all benefit from the utilities participating in that MISO market, that helps drive down costs, and it also increases the overall reliability. So the focus of the bill is not on those, not to impact those kinds of interactions, but more the long-term, long-term contracts for power to serve customer need.
Madam Chair and Mr. Bull, so that's a good answer and I understand it, but does this bill apply to the transactions that would take place that are purchased on the real-time market?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I don't believe so. But if there's concern about that, I think the Senate has taken some language that would address some of those issues. We're not quite comfortable with the way the language is currently drafted over there, but it is an issue that Great River has raised. I don't know how big an issue it is.
Madam Chair and Mr. Bull, Representative Stevenson, or I guess also Representative Stevenson, is it your intent to have this bill apply to those transactions, the real-time market transactions?
Representative Garofalo, as I said, the intent of the bill was to focus on the new resource construction. So I would say no, that's not the intent, but I do want to look more carefully at the language that has been suggested in the Senate and to think more carefully about how the interplay with MISO would work.
Madam Chair and Mr. Bull, so with regards to that then, it seems like the real-time market, if it's not the intended, I don't want to say target of this legislation, but that's not the sphere that I was looking at focusing on. If that's the case, it would seem that there is almost a regulatory preference or a regulatory incentive for utilities to stay away from power purchase agreements and to use the real-time market, because it would provide them more flexibility and potentially more affordability than going through power purchase agreements. Certainly there's other factors that play into it, but it would seem that the real-time market would provide a significant regulatory incentive to do that. Explain to me why I'm wrong.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, my sense of that is that the utilities want to be able to know where their power supply is coming from and what cost. So I think that the design of the utility resource planning process is such that it would there's still an importance for hedging some of the costs of those long-term contractual relationships and ownership of power plants. I do think that the utility sort of avoidance of risk, I don't know that they would fall prey to that kind of incentive that you reflect.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, if I could just add that there's a provision in the bill relating to utility ownership of replacement assets that you may have seen that has generated a lot of interest and discussion among particularly our IOUs, but even more generally than that. And that certainly indicates to me, even under the framework of this bill, that the utilities are very interested in owning generation facilities going forward.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, of course, there's perverse incentives in our regulatory structure. I'm thinking that, you know, this year we have a huge amount of renewable energy coming online with the new dam up in Manitoba Hydro. More capacity than they have power purchase agreements for. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that, especially when the Great Northern Transmission Line gets hooked up, that's going to provide provide some regulatory and pricing certainty that we're not taking into account today. It sounds like people are having these conversations and are aware of it. I just want to make sure that we're not. My primary concern for asking these questions is we don't walk into another lawsuit. I mean, we got absolutely smoked in the last one with the North Dakota lawsuit. And if we're out, if we're goofing around with real-time market purchases, we're going to lose again. We're going to end up making North Dakota rich again, and we're going to pay for their lawyers again. And I would just hope we don't do that again. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just Mr. Ball, I think, thank you. Just don't want to have you waste energy standing up. Just a kind of a question. So it's my understanding that this Clean Energy First will pertain not just to investor-owned utilities, but also cooperatives and municipals.
Correct.
Yes. So, you know, kind of talking about, you know, kind of that you're an advocate for this, you know, Conexus came up and talked about how their board of directors, you know, said, you know, this is the direction that we want to go.
Sure.
Do you feel that, you know best by advocating for this bill when it comes to power purchase agreements and or locally, elected officials within cooperatives and municipalities?
Madam Chair, Representative Swierczynski, I guess I wouldn't say that I know best. What we're working with in the Clean Energy First proposal is essentially a resource planning process that the co-ops and munis already participate in before the Public Utilities Commission. It's a different sort of structure, whereas the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities like Minnesota Power, XL, Otter Tail, bring their resource plans to the Commission for approval. But I think, as you know, the munis and co-ops bring their resource plans to the Commission, same kind of evaluation, but for advice. To lay out their proposals to the Commission and get their input on it. So it's not directive in the way that I think you might be thinking, that it's more advisory to those unions and co-ops.
Madam Chair, So that's an interesting perspective. You know, I'm just thinking about, you know, from an advisory standpoint to the change in direction, it seems as though this would potentially be overstepping some of the local boards in their decision making and their discretion and the relationships they've built and the wants and needs and what they see viable or not. And so I would just encourage you to, you know, as you are an advocate for this bill, and it sounds like, you know, maybe your organization is kind of pushing this a bit, that, you know, you consider local control, because I'm kind of wondering what the local boards will do, you know, if something like this moves forward. You know, what will they vote on? You know, what color to paint the office? I mean, what's going to be left?
Madam Chair, Representative Swierczynski, I don't see it that in that same way. I think that the role of the – I am actually a co-op customer, member, owner of Steel Waseca Cooperative. My sense is that the role of the distribution cooperatives and municipals will be the same. It'll be to try to manage, to work with their power supply provider, their municipal power agency, their generation transmission cooperative, in order to plan for the needs of that of their distribution cooperative. I don't think this bill changes that. It just changes the emphasis of some of the lower carbon resources that are available to them.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question for Ms. Fuji. You had mentioned earlier just your concern about the unknowns about this bill. There's a lot of uncertainty. What I'm having a hard time about is the push to get rid of the non-renewable plants, whether it's nuclear, whether it's the coal, natural gas in this bill. Because at some point, Ms. Fuji, we're going to have to figure out what to do when it's all gone. Is that what's giving you the heartburn? Can you expand on that concern? Because that's where I'm at, and maybe you can say it in a much better way. But what do we do once in 20 years, let's say, or 30 years? What are we going to do when those plants are no longer here and we don't have that quick recovery method? So your thoughts on that.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Baker, thank you for that. So I think the uncertainty, you know, Great River Energy is obviously planning for the future. We know that we've got a large coal-fired power plant. We have to do something with those emissions. We know that. And so we are constantly planning and thinking about that. I think all utilities are thinking about their generation resources. I think for us, the uncertainty more comes from how do we account for it, right? Within this bill, as Mr. Bull and Representative Stevenson talked about, this is a resource planning mechanism. This is our resource plan and how we look at our resources. Only our board has the ability to decide on the change in generation mix, but we are guided by the resource plan. And I think, you know, the questions that Representative Garofalo brought up are the ones that we're concerned with. How do we account for things within the resource plan? You know, if Great River Energy, as a not-for-profit utility, cannot take advantage of tax credits right now for to build renewable generation. So we don't. All of our wind are under power purchase agreements because developers have the appetite to absorb that tax credit. And so, again, we have to just figure out within the complexities of that how we account for various technologies. But again, only our board would be able to decide the change in the resource mix.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bradley Peterson. And then next, Rich Sabicol.
Thank you, Madam Mayor, Madam Chair, and members. Again, my name is Bradley Peterson with the firm of Flaherty & Hood, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities. These are the communities that host the very facilities that you're talking about, and our group consists of Becker, Cohasset, Oak Park Heights, Monticello, Red Wing, Granite Falls, Hoyt Lakes, and Fergus Falls. And so on behalf of those cities, I'm testifying on the inclusion of the host community language that we appreciate Representative Stevenson including on page 12 of the DE amendment. Hosting these plants has major impacts, including increased infrastructure and public safety costs borne by the local government, unique land use challenges that exist currently and long after these plants will go away, and any other numerous deep impacts and reach into the communities. Just as an example, the community center in Granite Falls is the Kilowatt Center, and it is on Kilowatt Drive. And so I think that's one indication of just the deep impact and deep presence that these facilities have had. And so as we contemplate these transitions, and I want to make it very clear, our communities realize that they are in no way able to influence or control these market forces or regulatory preferences that are being spoken about. They're concerned about what happens next. And in large part, that is due to the tax base that these power plants possess. Of the folks that were noted in the CEE community, 40 to 75% of their tax base is these facilities. And so we have a strong, we would strongly encourage you to take a hard look at Representative Christensen's bill, 1919, that not only begins to address these issues, but puts real resources behind it. We can't wait. And so as you consider bold action on the climate, it is incumbent upon the legislature to also consider bold action in terms of making for a just transition. Thank you.
Thank you. Rich Sabicol and then Sarah Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Richard Sabicol. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Martin and Squires here on behalf of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I do energy and utility work at the Minnesota Public Utility Commission, and I'm here on behalf of the chamber for that reason. The Minnesota Chamber members support clean energy and increasing renewables and agree with the core principle that renewable energy is preferable when it is cost competitive and reliable. The issue here is the rates have significantly increased for large energy users over the last 15 years, and we think this bill will exacerbate that problem. Our rates were once solidly below the national average, but are now above. In fact, we have the 13th highest rates for our members that are large consumers of energy. Ever-increasing rates put our state's economic competitiveness at risk and will have a real impact on communities that depend on large energy consumers and customers for jobs, revenue, and stability. Specifically, since 2006, our rates have increased over 50%, 50.169%. The national average for electric rate increases amongst other states, 18.88%. The inflation over that same period is 24.56. We were once almost 20% below the national average in electric rates, and now we are above. This is a competitive disadvantage. And for industrial ratepayers, large consumers of energy and employers, we are 14% above the national average. With that, the chamber is currently opposed to the bill as it is. It has serious ratepayer protection problems that need to be addressed. So I'm available for questions if there are any.
Representative Stevenson has the first question.
Yes, Madam Chair, Mr. Savicol, just a couple quick questions. I think you maybe heard some testimony earlier that the average cost for wind these days is in the $20 range and the average cost for coal is north of 40. Do you disagree with that, with those numbers?
I don't, but that's not the total cost of energy and delivering it to customers. The problem is not only in the cost of the kilowatt hour, but it's the capacity needed, the replacement of power that's needed when the wind isn't blowing, when the sun isn't shining, the added transmission that we've heard today. We don't know what the cost of that is. So it's a totality of costs that the ratepayers need to think about when they're paying their bills.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, would you tell me the price in Minnesota went up about 50%. What was the length of time? I missed the first part of that.
2006.
From 2006, so about 14 years. Okay, thank you very much.
Don't see any further questions. Thank you for your testimony, Sarah Wolf, and then Rob Scott Hovland.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, members of the committee. I'm Sarah Wolf. I'm with the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. We are a coalition of over 70 organizations across Minnesota, and we are focused on addressing the climate crisis, which affects each of the issues we care about more than any other. I'd like to frame up, as you all well know, but frame up the urgency of our situation, because our long game is actually not that long. We've already exceeded the safe levels of greenhouse gas emissions that are in our air, and so each additional amount that we add has consequences that we'll feel now and in the future. And I'd also like to, on the hopeful side, really uplift the way policy directs innovation and investment. And like to remember that back in 2007, when the legislature passed the Next Generation Energy Act and a requirement to meet 25% renewable electricity by 2025, no one knew how that would exactly get done. But that goal was met in 2018. Regarding the legislation that's in front of you today, Clean Energy First, it's really important to understand how different the House and Senate versions that are being discussed are. There really is a wide gap in many categories. The House version is much more consistent with longstanding Minnesota policy favoring renewables and energy efficiency, and it makes additions and clarifications in a continuation of Minnesota's vision for this clean energy future. It is a step forward. The Senate bill, in contrast, moves backward. It does that by weakening the existing statute we have, reducing the requirement from planning for all energy needs to only planning for new energy needs. And it creates, in this version of the Senate version, creates a preference that includes carbon-intensive and carbon-emitting fossil fuel-burning technology that captures only a portion of the greenhouse gas emissions and allows that to be injected back into the ground to push out more oil. It also creates a preference for garbage burning and makes numerous exemptions, as have been discussed earlier. Finally, I'd just like to say that I appreciate, and I know you all do too, the difference between what is hard and what takes planning. The impacts of the climate crisis are hard. From wildfires to floods to crops that aren't growing, the way these are impacting our communities, that is hard. Planning, on the other hand, is what we are doing here today. And we need that planning, planning to meet the goals that biology, physics, and chemistry require of us, planning to repair and uplift communities that have been impacted by pollution and those communities that will go through a process of transition, and making sure that our plans do not leave anyone behind or out in the cold. Thank you so much for your work today.
Representative Swazinski has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your testimony. So, you know, obviously, you know, most issues that people work on are kind of an incremental approach. You know, this kind of looks forward to the future a little bit. You know, in a perfect world, kind of what would your organization kind of say would be the perfect bill that would actually make a difference? What would you advocate for that would be beyond this bill or less than this bill? What would that be?
I think that the version that you're discussing here today does take a step forward in terms of the resource planning, and that is positive.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of a follow-up. What would be, you know, obviously is this the last bill that you'll be advocating for it as an organization that represents over 70 groups across the state and nation? Kind of what would be your perfect plan that would be like, if we had one last bill to pass, what would that be?
That's not a possible question to address with one bill. This is a transformation that we're tracking across many different sectors in ways that when we do it the right way creates positive co-benefits across those sectors as well. I'm sorry, I can't answer with one bill.
Representative Baker?
And thank you. And to the testifier, I think I want to agree with you that this is about planning. I think that my concern, and I think we've heard some other testifiers of the concern, is that the guardrails on this plan are too narrow. And I think what we need to do is we need to still continue to look at long-range plans that do include some cleaner fossil fuel and other options, so that when planners have to actually put spades in the ground and engineering on a piece of paper to get electrons from point A to point B, which I am nowhere near that capacity, we have to make sure we give them all the tools that they need to do better planning and more efficient planning with the tools and the science we have at that time. So would you at least maybe agree that our way to agree to disagree here is that we're just trying to make sure that those guardrails are not too tight in a time when we don't have exactly the science to get there? Because that brings a lot of nervousness to utility companies that want to charge more for not knowing how much it's going to cost. Do you see that, at least recognizing that that's the issues that at least I'm having with this planning process, is the guardrails?
I'm not the best person here to speak to specific guardrails. However, I do want to emphasize that the technology for moving to renewables to support the energy needs that our state has is very strong, and there are many studies that suggest that we can meet a great, great majority of our needs with those renewable energy sources. And to say that the policies that we enact now are very important to guide what kind of future investment and innovation is needed to take place to meet our total goals.
Thank you.
I see no further questions. Thank you so much. Rob Scott Hovland and then Justin Fay.
Chair Guineas and members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify on House File 1405 today. My name is Rob Scott Hovland, and I represent Missouri River Energy Services. We are a municipal power agency that provides wholesale power to 61 municipal electric utilities across four states. 25 of those are here in greater Minnesota. We are not-for-profit, customer-owned, and customer-operated. Missouri River has made significant processes towards a clean energy future. Over the past 15 years, we have made strides in reducing our carbon footprint and will continue to invest in clean energy as well as energy efficiency, load management, and capacity that ensures grid reliability. We appreciate Representative Stevenson has been very willing to discuss this issue with, and work on legislation with us. We continue to have concerns in several areas, and I would like to focus on Subdivision 8, which would require us to conduct an analysis of our operating coal resource on a seasonal basis. As we understand it, Subdivision 8 is aimed at encouraging utilities to ramp down their coal resources when it's economically feasible. Although this goal is worthy, the one-size-fits-all approach for this subdivision will not work for all utilities. Missouri River has a 16.5% stake in a coal facility named Laramie River Station in Wyoming. Laramie River Station operates as a part of the Southwest Power Pool, which is a regional transmission organization similar to MISO. As a minority owner, we are not the operator of that facility. Nonetheless, Laramie River Station is already operating on it based on an economic dispatch model that we believe meets the intent of Subdivision 8. As a member of SPP, we are required to have generating capacity equal to the needs of our members, plus a reserve margin, and to provide that capacity to the market. Because we are a small utility, we don't have the ability to shut down our largest resource on a seasonal basis. Rather, that facility must be offered to SPP, and SPP decides whether it will operate. That decision is based on economic and reliability considerations. Although it is not seasonal, the current process results in our unit going offline when it is not economical to do so. In fact, Laramie River Station was offline for 20 days last October, 17 days in November, 9 days in December, and 18 days in January. Requiring Missouri River to perform this seasonal operational analysis will not change our obligation to make Laramie River Station available to the SPP market. The required remodeling would only add additional costs for our members. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to comment, and I look forward to working with Representative Stevenson on this legislation. Thank you.
I don't see any questions. Justin Fay and then Rick Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. My name is Justin Fay. I'm here today on behalf of Fresh Energy. We appreciate the opportunity to share a few brief thoughts on House File 1405, the Clean Energy First Act. House File 1405 provides a clear roadmap for Minnesota's electric utilities, regulators, state agencies, and other energy stakeholders for how resource decisions should be made in an era when renewable energy is consistently the least cost option. And carbon reduction is a public policy imperative. Utility resource planning is extraordinarily complex, and to be done well requires certainty and predictability. Changes to Minnesota's established process for resource planning should be done carefully and prudently. However, as others have noted, the existing language in statute that describes how renewable energy should be treated in resource planning is now more than 25 years old. And we believe that House File 1405 provides a comprehensive set of updates that position Minnesota's regulatory framework well for the coming decades. There are multiple versions of Clean Energy First legislation that have been made public, and they are all quite different. We believe that House File 1405 does an excellent job of aligning utility resource planning with our state policy goals for greenhouse gas reduction, as well as with the simple realities of today's electricity market. Representative Stevenson deserves a great deal of credit for working with a broad set of stakeholders that we've already heard from today to develop legislation that truly is clean energy first. We look forward to additional conversations with members of this committee and other impacted parties as the bill moves forward, and we encourage members to vote yes on House File 1405. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick Evans and then Mike Berkland.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. The first thing I want to note is that, as everyone in the room knows, Xcel Energy's CEO announced a year and a half ago that we would be moving away from our coal units toward cleaner energy. And as a result of our latest resource plan, we will be closing all of our coal units in the state of Minnesota by 2030. To borrow Mr. Prentice's analogy, that's the big red fire engine, if you ask me, and we're very proud of that, and we think we're making great progress, and we think we'll continue to make great progress regardless of the outcome of this bill, which in various forms we have supported, but we continue to have some reservations. I will say that Representative Stevenson has been very generous with his time and listened to us on a number of issues and has pledged to continue to do so, and we hope to continue to work with him as this bill moves on. I will just very briefly refer to two sections. It's a very complicated bill. We have, you know, some concerns with different parts of it. I'm just going to mention two of them here today because the time is brief, and I know the bill's going to require a lot more work as it moves through the process. The first is the definitions that start on page 4. Nuclear energy, anyone who read the Star Tribune newspaper over the weekend knows that nuclear energy is a key component of reaching a carbon-free future. And Xcel Energy, as the only nuclear utility in Minnesota, has been recognized as having that as a strong asset. In fact, even in this bill, we take on additional responsibilities in recognition of the fact that we have nuclear units. In this bill, unfortunately, nuclear is not defined anywhere. It's not renewable, it's not non-renewable, it's not carbon-free, it's not carbon-emitting, it's not anything. And I submit you cannot put together a complicated resource plan without acknowledging the fact that we have three very large power generators in the state that have to be taken into consideration. And so we look forward to working with, we believe, of course, that nuclear should be recognized for what it is, a carbon-free resource in the resource planning process, and we will be continuing to urge that position. The second thing, and I'll talk about just very briefly, is what we kind of come to call the ownership provisions that are on page 9. You know, if the utility does not own generation assets, then the utility is going to acquire that generation through power purchase agreements. Power purchase agreements is energy that is purchased from non-regulated entities. It is not subject to regulation by the PUC and the legislature in the same way that owned assets are. They are typically locking us into decisions for 20 to 25 years in long-term contracts. We think that there's a strong reason why utilities ought to follow the traditional model in Minnesota and own generation assets. We think that the earlier versions of the bill properly balanced the interests of our customers with the interests of the utilities and the interests of the state in owning assets. And we would strongly encourage the legislature to return to that model. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions, and thank you again for the time to speak.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans, Mr. Savokul from the chamber made some statements about rates in the state, and I'm curious if you agree with his interpretation of rates or if you'd like to correct the record at all.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you know, rates are what they are. I mean, it's just math. So I haven't seen the math that Mr. Savokul refers to. I don't know if he's referring to rates exclusively, if he's also referring to the fuel clause, which we talked about last week with respect to community solar gardens, or exactly what parts of that he's referring to. We are very, very sensitive to rates. We are very, very sensitive to reliability, and we're very, very sensitive to safety. And we are very, very sensitive to clean energy. Putting all of those things in balance is tricky. And I know that's what this bill is trying to address. So we have sympathy for our customers who are seeing rate increases. I just don't have the material in front of me to specifically address Mr. Savokul's numbers.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans, I appreciate your testimony. You know, we heard from your IRP that at least for the near term, you don't really need more capacity, and you don't need more transmission. So why do you think we need this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative, It is helpful to give the Public Utilities Commission direction on how to do resource planning. That is a role of the legislature to set the policies that they would like that to see come out of that. We have some serious concerns with the direction that this bill gives to the PUC, but we want to continue to work on those. So, you know, one of the things that goes into resource planning is resources, but, you know, it does not ignore transmission or distribution and all of those other things. In fact, every cost that is assigned to a resource in a resource plan carries with it the cost of transmitting it. Wouldn't make any sense to plan for a resource that you couldn't deliver to your customers. So we think the resource plan is a very robust tool. It's extremely complicated. We would, you know, greatly like to simplify this bill so that the legislature was giving clear direction to the PUC about where they want the resource plan to come out. And so we do support that concept of communicating to the PUC from the policymakers where they want that to come out. We do have some concerns about some of the details, some of the, maybe I'll say micromanaging, that might be a little too strong, that goes into the bill sometimes.
Senator Baker.
Madam Chair, Mr. Evans, a couple questions. What is your current resource plan in front of the PUC? What is the recommendations for rate increase in front of the PUC right now before they make any decision? But what was the request?
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, I'm not sure I understand. I mean, the resource planning requires the PUC to look at cost, reliability, safety, and increasingly clean energy, and they have to balance all of those things. But it does not specifically set rates.
Madam Chair, maybe my question was wrong. Is there a current rate increase requested in front of the PUC?
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, there is not from Xcel. There was a couple of weeks ago. We had proposed a rate case. Almost everything driving that rate case, I forget the percentage, but it's a very high percentage of what was driving that rate case, had to do with declining sales. We have a lot of machinery out there that was based on expectations of growing sales. What we've seen is declining sales. If you think of rates as dollars over kilowatt hours, if you have fewer kilowatt hours, the rate's going to be higher. What we were able to do with the PUC was reach an agreement for essentially a stay out by truing up our rates based on sales. Since sales is something we don't have a great deal of control over as opposed to costs, the PUC has agreed to that we would stay out of a rate case. We've agreed with them that we would stay out of a rate case by truing up our rates to reflect the fact that our sales are down.
Madam Chair, so to better understand that, and I didn't realize that that had been withdrawn from the PUC, so thank you for that. And maybe just to understand this better, because the Representative Long brought up rates and is this accurate? I think it's important for us to kind of know what is right and what is accurate, and there's just a lot of different ways to look at information. So it sounds like you pulled that, but maybe I just need to know from my background, what was that rate increase request, if it's okay to talk about that? I'm sure it was public, because I thought it was around 20%. I could be wrong. I thought I heard a number, but I want to make sure it's verified, and I will have a follow-up.
My company is very smart, and they don't let me get very close to math. So I don't know the number, but I will certainly get it for you, and I'll share it with the members of the committee.
Okay. And to that, I heard it was a pretty significant request. And, again, it was only that. And it sounds like you've got some understanding with the PUC, because part of that, I think, had to do with what we talked a lot about last week, which was community solar gardens and the increase in those rates, because that's all part of your rate fuel adjustment and your overall plan. And everything we were talking about today sounds like solar and wind is getting cheaper by the month, especially in solar. It is getting 1% cheaper every month. That is a great statement that was made today in testimony, but it's not being recognized on a lot of Xcel Energy's fuel charge. So as we have these conversations going forward, I just wanted to find out if I want to believe this 50% that the Minnesota Chamber gave to us is somewhat accurate. I don't know. I don't have that verification. I know there was an increase in front of the PUC. So I think members were seeing some indications that there are some moving things coming at the PUC that we can't control if we're not maximizing every part of the portfolio that requires energy to flow, the transmission, the reliability, renewable. Everything has to be talked about in a manner that, again, reliability has to be paramount for everybody, and I think affordability should be number two, and then it's the renewable. So I just want to make sure that we're talking about the whole scope here, and I appreciate your comments, so thank you.
Representative Bierman has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Evans. Could you also comment, please, on the effects of rate increases at Xcel in regards to the transmission expansion and improvements, and also the improvements to nuclear generation and the efforts to make that more efficient, and how big of a piece of this rate increase do those two things, which are essentially upkeep and improvement of the existing model and structure, how is that affecting rates, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, I don't have that either at my fingertips here, but I will make sure that we share that with the committee.
Thank you. Mike Berkland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Good morning. I'm here today representing the 32,000 men and women who work in Minnesota's forest products industry, the folks who work in the mills. And I've been in this role now for 6 weeks, so I'm kind of new to the role. But prior to that, was with an electric cooperative, a local distribution co-op, for 19 years, and then worked in the forest products industry prior to that for a company that at one time had 2,800 employees in the state and now is down to 80. And at one time had 6 manufacturing facilities and now is down to 1. So I'm here today representing really an industry, though, that is still vital in this state. It represents a $9 billion economic impact on an annual basis. And I talked about the 32,000 employees, and then brings revenues into state coffers through timber sales up to $21 million a year. And with all public agencies combined, brings in revenues of $47 million a year. So it's also an industry that's really practiced a lot of sustainability initiatives over the years and recycled content into the manufacturing of paper. Maybe some of the paper that you have in front of you today was manufactured in Minnesota. And also some of those sustainability goals that have been part of the industry since before the discussion of recycled content or the discussion of sustainability even came to tables like the ones you're sitting at here today. I think the bill and the industry looks at the bill. There's some concerns, certainly. I'll speak to those in a moment. But I think from the standpoint of some of the good points, certainly the bill looks out for local labor and the inclusion of local labor. We think those are good things. It also protects utilities and investor-owned utilities specifically and their rate of return. And it helps communities that will lose power plants. Those are all good things for those folks. What we don't see are the protections for any energy-intensive industries that employ hundreds of people, that are industries that have been under stress and duress, natural resource-based industries that use a lot of electricity but also employ lots of people in rural areas. And so our strong concerns are about really the cost of this infrastructure. Who will pay for the changes? Who will pay for the transmission? Who will pay for the additional assets that need to be built? So we'd like to see, as the bill stands, again, we're strongly concerned about it, and we'd like to see the state invest in a policy through this process that recognizes the value of our natural resource-based economy and also recognizes the fact that that we've got folks working in these mills who also have to pay their electric bills. And right now, the way the bill is constructed, it leaves very little room or no room at all, really, for large intensive power users and really puts those competitive industries at risk.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Thank you. Members, it is now 11:15. We have 17 amendments. We will go into recess. We will recess until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We will start. Testimony is finished. Nobody else has signed up. and we will start with amendments, and we will go until we finish. So just keep that in mind for whatever you plan to eat or whatever. We're not going to be back in this same room, so put it in your head. We are going to be in room 400 South at 4 o'clock. Everybody got it? We are in recess. Members, we will reconvene, and welcome back. We do have an additional public testifier that has to chat with us, and so we'll take 2 minutes to do that, and then we will do, if Adam Hanson would come forward.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Adam Hanson. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors. We represent commercial and industrial builders throughout the state, many of whom build the wind and solar projects we're going to be talking about this afternoon. I want to talk about one thing that's included in the Delete All amendment that was adopted earlier this afternoon related to prevailing wage. With prevailing wage laws, the state of Minnesota and the Department of Labor and Industry continue to rely on a decades-old calculation method and a survey process to determine each county's prevailing wage rates. In a study done in 2017, the Minnesota Center of Fiscal Excellence determined that 72% of all prevailing wage rates in the state were either outdated or from a neighboring county or both. Because of the flawed wage survey and calculation method, we often see prevailing wage rates that are noticeably higher than the true market wage rates in the area. Costs are estimated to increase on average of 10% when prevailing wage rates are mandated on construction. This is one of the reasons why advocates of affordable housing, renewable energy, and rural broadband funds routinely ask the legislature for exemptions from prevailing wage rates and requirements when state dollars are issued. Another thing to consider is that utilities like Xcel, co-ops, and others can voluntarily adopt prevailing wage requirements on their projects without the state mandating them in the first place. Having the state mandate these rates is unprecedented in our state. Prevailing wage rates also don't guarantee a project to be done using local workers, the project to be done on time, or any level of safety. Many of our contractor members throughout Minnesota and North Dakota, who we also represent, already build these state-of-the-art wind and solar and utility-scale energy projects using local workers without prevailing wage mandates and all without issue. One of the country's most prolific wind project builders in the country happens to be in Granite Falls in Representative Swiedzinski's district. They built some of the tallest wind projects in the country. The state's largest solar installer is also one of our members. They're down in Goodhue. They're the number one installer of megawatts per hour for solar and number 24 in the country. These contractors self-perform their work using local workers on time and on budget for their project owners and without the state mandating prevailing wage rates for those private projects. Both contractors that are our members and others in your districts would not be successful if they didn't pay their workers and their craft professionals a good wage and a good benefit package already. So I'd ask the committee reconsider the use of prevailing wage rates on these projects that are completely privately funded. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard testimony this morning from the laborers about their concern about losing high-paying jobs and some of the fossil fuel industry and the need for equivalent high-paying jobs in the energy industry. My understanding was that this provision is supported by wind developers in particular, and that there's been an ongoing relationship being built with developers and labor. I'm curious why you all are taking a different position from the wind companies on this.
Madam Chair and Representative Long, one thing that we do know in our industry is that a one-size-fits-all wage determination isn't right for every company or every individual worker. If a developer voluntarily wants to partner with organized labor and become a signatory contractor or have a union-only project, that's the developer and then the contractor's decision. But to have the state mandate that every company, regardless of labor affiliation, pay prevailing wage rates when their business doesn't operate that way, I don't think it's a good thing for the state to involve itself into those private arrangements.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just who are you with again? As far as
Associated Builders and
okay,
Contractors.
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate that. Now, just interesting, you know, how we're pushing to have prevailing wage in this portion, which is private funded, and then where it's a state mandate, where we're, you know, like the community wind farms and kind of that special carve-out area where we have a lot of special interests that are building things that state mandated amounts were not. And so I just think that's kind of an interesting dichotomy where we have something that's very controlled and forced upon the industry, and then the stuff that you're doing on your own, we are. So just a unique perspective.
I don't see any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson moves that House File 1405 be returned to the Committee on Ways and Means. But we have amendments before us. And Representative Bierman and Representative Christensen aren't here, so I'm going to start with Amendment A14, which I believe is Representative Long's.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A14.
Do you want to speak to your amendment, Representative Long?
Sure, Madam Chair. We heard this amendment in committee last week. We heard the bill in committee last week. This is a pretty straightforward amendment requiring reports to customers about the information on their generation sources for the utilities.
I don't see any questions.
Madam Chair.
Members, Representative
Swisenski,
you're going to have to.
I'm sorry. I normally don't sit over this tight to you on your left side, so I just like a roll call on this amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Representative Wong?
Yes.
Representative Swisenski?
Nay.
Representative Acomb?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
No.
Okay. Representative Bierman? Representative Bowe?
No.
Representative Christensen? Representative Garofalo?
What? No, I'm not.
Representative Poinstein?
Yes.
Representative Jordan?
Yes.
Representative Mahoney?
Yes.
Representative Meckland?
No.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Stevenson?
Yes.
Being 7 ayes and 6 nays, the amendment is adopted. The next amendment we will take is A4. Is there an author for A4?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move A4 amendment. This amendment, we heard about this this morning. Apparently the Senate heard about this afternoon in a briefing, and we talked about it heavily last night at the event, I believe it was at the History Center. Include carbon capture as a renewable, while many of you said it's not 100%, but it's 80%, and 80% is a lot closer to your goal. So I'd like you to take this as a favorable amendment, if you would.
What?
I don't see any
other. Madam Chair, I don't know if you want me to comment on the amendment.
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Meckland, I will not take this as a friendly amendment. Among other things, you referenced the 80% language, which is currently in, actually it's not in the Senate bill. The Senate bill is currently at 90%, but in either event, this amendment has no percent in it. So my read of it would be that you could have 5% and it would qualify underneath this amendment. So I would not accept this amendment.
For me too.
Amendment A4 is before you, members. The author of the bill recommends a no vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
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 The amendment is not adopted. We're going to go to A6. Someone offering an A6 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Give me a second here.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A6 amendment, and this would help specify priority for the helping the host communities, as we've talked about. I wish Representative Christensen was here, and basically it just inserts language that the commission shall, to the maximum extent possible, prioritize the hiring of workers from communities hosting retirement power plants, including but not limited to Becker, Monticello, Park Heights, and Red Lake.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the author for bringing this amendment. I think it's a really important issue that we heard a lot about, and we've been hearing a lot about, and we talked about earlier today. And so I would accept this amendment.
We will still have to vote on the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The next amendment we will look at is A7. Is there somebody who's
ready? Madam Chair, I believe the A15 author's amendment fixed that typo, so we're good to go. I will withdraw that amendment.
So the A7 is the which amendment?
A7.
And we have the A8.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A8 amendment. This amendment simply removes the word unreasonably from the section on the rate impact for seasonal operations of the coal plant, essentially that shouldering that we're looking at. And then when we consider this bill separately, we have the discussion on the rate impact. And, you know, the proponent said it would reduce the bills overall, is my understanding, by reducing the fuel costs, even the potential increases of other rate components. So I don't know if the A15 potentially did fix it or not, but if we are going to do the seasonal operations to save ratepayers money, but still the language result in potential rate increases. So I think we've kind of got some unintended consequences going on here. So I'd ask for a roll call if I could.
Representative Spasinski is asking for a roll call vote. Would Representative Stevenson, who is the author, please comment?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Spasinski. You know, we did have this amendment presented on the coal holiday bill, and the commitment that I made to you at that time was that I was going to work on this issue and figure out a way to write the language such that it wouldn't increase overall cost for ratepayers. I continue to believe that this amendment is not the way to accomplish that, and I completely intend to honor that commitment to you. We just haven't come up with the language yet. I met with a number of people last week to discuss it, and I'm still working on it. I would ask you to withdraw the amendment again, but I wouldn't accept this amendment now. I don't think it gets at the bigger problem that we're looking at.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Spasinski, are you requesting a roll call? All right, the roll call has been requested. The author of the bill suggests a no vote, and the chair votes no.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Spasinski?
Aye.
Representative Acom?
No.
Representative Baker?
Aye.
Representative Bierman?
No.
Representative Bowe?
Yes.
Representative Christensen? Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Jordan?
No.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative Mecklen?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Stevenson?
No.
Six ayes and eight nays. The amendment is not adopted. The next amendment we'll look at is A9. Does someone have that amendment?
Madam Chair, I'll move the A9 amendment. And this is a conversation we had earlier today. I mentioned Representative Stevenson regarding the short-term and real-term purchases of electricity on the real-time market. Take the author at his word, it was not his intent to capture that. I do worry about litigious outside organizations, though, trying to enforce that, so that's the purpose of my amendment.
The author would like to comment on A9.
I would, Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo. It was an interesting discussion earlier today and one that I'd like to continue to have. I am concerned about this particular attempt to get at the issue. The word long-term isn't really defined. I think there's some vagueness in this amendment. I think it's worth having continued discussion about. I do want to maintain the position that I took earlier today and that Mr. Bull took, that the bill in its present form doesn't affect these contracts, but that's not to say it's not worth looking at or trying to find additional language that could provide some comfort and avoid litigation. I just don't think this is it, so I'd ask for a no vote.
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, you know, when I was door knocking in Farmington, a lot of people talked to me about real-time pricing on the MISO grid. This is a crucial issue. So I'm going to ask for a roll call on this amendment, please.
Okay. Representative Garofalo has asked for a roll call vote so that he can talk to people in Farmington. So with that,
they did elect him.
The author of the bill recommends a no vote, and the chair will vote no.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Swazinski?
Aye.
Representative Acomb?
No.
Representative Baker? Representative Bierman?
No.
Representative Bowe?
Yes.
Representative Christensen? Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Jordan?
No.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative Meckland?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Stevenson?
No.
Moving 6 ayes and 8 noes, the amendment is not adopted. We are now looking at A10. Does someone have that amendment?
Madam Chair, I will take that. And to the author, I guess I want to offer the A10 amendment. A couple questions I have. What this section does, and I was asking about it earlier with some testifiers. First of all, to the author, was this in the original bill?
Madam Chair, President Baker. When you say the original bill, I guess I'm going to need some clarification. There have been so many versions of this bill. I don't know what bill you're referring to.
Has there been any version that has brought? I remember a bill last year. I don't recall if you carried it or if it was some other representative, but it was really about all electrification. It was kind of like poo-pooing the natural gas folks. It was anything fossil fuel was kind of like get rid of it. Okay. This is sort of that in a very condensed fashion. I don't think it's been in any other bill, but this is the first time I've been able really to kind of hone in on it, and it's part of your bill now. Maybe just help me understand the purpose of section 10 on page 7. To just it appears to me that it's kind of instructing the PUC to let's get rid of the non-renewable generating plants. You know, you've got it headlined as favoring electricity resources state policy. Just maybe because there's a lot of clarity I need in this, will you help me with this, understand what this means and what your intent is for this?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I think I know what bill you're referring to. I don't know that I agree with your characterization of it, of that particular bill. In fact, I know that I don't disagree with your characterization.
Yeah, go with it, though.
I also disagree with your characterization of what this section of the bill does. To answer your question about whether it was in the bill last year, I didn't mean to dismiss it overall. It was in the bill that passed the House floor. So it was addressed last year, separate and distinct from the other bill that you mentioned. I think that this bill does not have the effect that you suggested that it does. I think that this language makes the pretty obvious statement that if we're going to meet the goals that we have already set as a state, we're going to need to be focusing on clean energy resources and other the technologies are listed here: wind, solar, energy storage, demand response. Those are the technologies that are going to bring us to the goals that we've already set as a state, goals we're not on track to meet now.
And Madam Chair, maybe just so you this is giving, correct me if I'm wrong, I guess is what I want to ask. So let's get down to the nuts and
bolts of this thing is that this looks like it gives direction to the PUC to eliminate really any fossil fuels or any other non-renewable energy. Let me just stop there. Am I accurate in that assumption with this paragraph?
I think you are inaccurate. I don't see anything in here that would eliminate anything.
Let me just read it.
I don't see the word eliminate. It says favored electrical resources state policy. It's the title of that section.
So you've got, these are the points that you got. And given significant continuing reductions in the cost of wind technology, solar technologies, energy storage, and demand response technologies. First of all, what does demand response technologies mean?
This is energy efficiency. It's trying to manage the amount of load that you have at a given time.
And then I'll continue. The favored method to meet electricity demand in Minnesota. So to me, those are the four technologies that you're focused on in this paragraph. Are you still thinking that this is where you want the PUC to go with this? And you just, because you, there's a statement here, state policy. I mean, it's a pretty bold statement. It's even in bold. And I just want to know that this is, the intent is, you know, here's where we're going with this. In fact, earlier in the bill, I think on the second page, you don't even want to recognize nuclear power as carbon-free. You don't want to use that power source as part of our plan. So that's where I'm kind of just, I want to get it to understand this, because I think I heard folks come to the table, GRE and maybe XL and others, that just there's some concerns about sections of this bill that they're concerned about. This is the one that I was focusing on, and I just want to better understand it. Is that what your intent is, or do you think, no, Dave, you're reading way too into it, fossil fuels are still part of the future, maybe it's carbon capture, maybe it's other things that we've been hearing about, but I just want to understand this better, and I'm sorry to repeat this, I just want to understand it.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I don't think you're repeating it. I don't mind digging into the clarity here. What I would disagree with you on is that this is about eliminating anything. I don't think that this section of the bill has that force or effect. I think that this section of the bill is pointing the PUC in the direction that we want to go as a state to meet the goals that we established in many cases a long time ago. You know, the renewable energy preference that focuses on those same technologies was adopted in 1993. Our greenhouse gas reduction goals were adopted in 2007 on a bipartisan basis. And what this section is about is recognizing that to meet the goals that we have set as a state, we are going to have to focus on these technologies in order to do it. I think that that's what the section is about. I don't see the word eliminate. I don't see how the PUC could use this to eliminate this section to eliminate anything.
Yeah. Appreciate that. I hope the members consider this in their votes. Thank you very much.
We have A10 before us, members. The author of the bill recommends a no vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. The next amendment before us, members, is A11.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move forward to A11. This is pretty simple. Representative Garofalo just addressed this afternoon, as well as this morning, about lawsuits in North Dakota making money off of us. So all this simply is adding the term in-state after non-renewable. So that doesn't apply to anything out of state. Except this is a favorable amendment.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would not accept this as a favorable amendment. I would note that the language you are seeking to amend has been in effect since 1993 and we've not been sued on it. I don't think it's necessary. I think that it's a misreading of the North Dakota litigation to think that it would be necessary, and I would urge a no vote.
Okay, members, A11 is before you. The author of the bill recommends a no vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
Not adopted. We have next A16. Does somebody want to offer that?
Yeah, I will move that amendment.
Yes, and I'm just kind of a little bit wondering, you know, the word mining. You know, that we've got on page 4 here, you know, just kind of wondering, you know, on a lot of these, it's, you know, talking about local jobs, and then it throws in mining. And I'm just wondering if the author could help me understand, you know, why mining is listed and there's not other, you know, high energy intensity jobs listed, but mining is spelled out.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I think that, you know, we've had a lot of discussion today and otherwise about the sensitive nature of mining jobs in the context of energy and their importance to our economy in Minnesota, particularly in the northeastern portion of the state. And so I think it is appropriate to include mining in this section of the bill.
So do you think that this bill would probably have a negative impact on the cost of mining?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, quite the opposite. I expect this bill to be focusing on affordability and reliability. We heard today that wind and solar are the cheapest forms of energy, and they are getting cheaper. And so I expect that this bill will make it cheaper.
I see no other comments.
I have a comment, Madam Chair, if that's okay. I don't think
there's
amendments on either, but
go ahead. So, I guess you know, I've heard some, you know, concerns, especially last, you know, a year ago, you know, the mines were idled, and I mean that was an expense, you know, a huge expense because I mean they needed to save electricity for, you know, during that polar vortex, and you know, and then getting them started back up. You know, the amount of energy it took to get them started back up because it wasn't just a flip the switch and everything's running again. You know, it took, you know, several days to maybe over a week to get started. And so that's it was a tremendous electric load to be able to do that. And, you know, can we have assurance for the mines, or is this what this is doing in this part asking about the mines to be studying it and allow them to make sure that, you know, it's a clean power, stable power, that it's going to be there for them so that they don't have to shoulder during the winter time.
Chair, Representative Nelson, let's be clear about what this section of the bill is about. Your amendment would delete mining or employment from the mining industry from the definition of local jobs impact. Right now, the bill asks the PUC to consider local job impacts in making decisions about resource planning. And what you are proposing to do is take mining out of that section. So what I would like to do is ensure that the PUC is considering this very important industry as it's evaluating proposed resource plans. And I think that what your amendment does is takes that out.
Okay. Madam Chair, so you're done with your questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson, if it's going to lower prices, why would the PUC need to keep mining in consideration?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, as I said before, I think that we know that mining is a very energy-intensive industry, and we know of its critical importance to our economy, particularly in northeastern Minnesota, and so I think it's appropriate for them to take a look at it. I believe that it will come out that this will be a benefit to our mining industry. But what this bill is about is setting up a framework around three values: carbon reduction, affordability, and reliability. And if it doesn't, we'll have the math to prove it out.
Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson, I hear the words coming out of your mouth, and I hear what you're saying. However, we just had a vote on an amendment where there was preference given to four types of energy sources, and one of the sources was not hydro. And Minnesota Power has made a multi-$100 million investment in the Great Northern Transmission Line for hydro in Canada. So I hear what you're saying, but explain to me how, if the goal is carbon emissions, that you are not giving that preferential status to the investments they've already made in a carbon-free energy source.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think that what is important is to look at what section of the bill we're talking about. When you're saying giving preference, you're talking about Section 10 of the bill. That's not the renewable energy preference. And so I don't know that it's giving preference. It's saying that the policy of the state is to move in that direction, which is what's necessary to meet those goals. But in terms of looking at the renewable energy preference, that's a different section of the bill.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, I'll just read it. It says, favored electricity resources state policy. Now, I don't think the Iron Range has annexed themselves into Wisconsin quite yet, or Canada, but that would be a statewide policy. And in there, we are prescribing those favored status technologies. So we have wind, we have solar, we have energy storage, and we have demand response technologies. Now, we have this other language here where we're talking about the issue of mining, and we're saying, well, no, we have to take this into account for mining. And my question is, if that's the concern, if the concern is mining, the fact that it's an energy-intensive, trade-exposed industry, why would we then, in another section of the bill, specifically cut out favored status for something that Minnesota Power has already made huge investments in and is carbon-free? I'm reading Section 10. I know what it says. Yes. I see the headline here, right? That doesn't make any sense.
As I said, Madam Chair, Representative Ruffel, I think it's important to look at the bill as a whole and consider, among other things, Section 6 of the bill. I think also it's important to understand what Section 10 does or doesn't. That's not the renewable energy preference. That's not the section of the bill that governs how the PUC looks at resource plans. It's stating that the policy of the state is to encourage the resources that we know will help us meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals.
And Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, does Hydro do that?
I think that, you know, Hydro is a valuable resource that we do include in this bill, just not in the section you're referring.
Okay, so Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson, I'm looking at a subdivision, again, favored electricity resources state policy. It would seem to me that if the stated goal that's been brought forward by the DFL is carbon emission reduction, we would want to recognize that as having an equal preference to wind, solar, demand response, and other technologies. This is why when we come back, this is the nexus to the reference we're making on the mining. Mining is essentially, and with few exceptions, it's Minnesota Power. And we can drag the Minnesota Power folks up here to testify. We can reference the document we got from the mining industry earlier today. They've made significant investments in hydro. And we're hearing that costs are going to be lower. This is a divide by zero error, Madam Chair.
Representative Long.
I think, Madam Chair, to answer your question, Representative Garofalo, Section 10 does refer to hydro. If you look on line 7.12, the preferred, the favored electricity resources, a combination of clean energy resources are defined on lines 4.17 to 4.19 as including renewable energy. If you flip back a page, line 3.15, renewable energy. So we do include hydro in the preference.
I should have consulted with my lawyer.
Yeah, it's still a good idea.
I think we're ready to vote.
I'm gonna withdraw my amendment.
All right, the amendment that's A16 has been withdrawn. Next, members, we will go to A17.
All right, I will offer that amendment. And this here amendment would just have the PUC. Study impact on the plan, just for how it's going to affect the mining industry, and heard that there was quite a lot of support for the mining industry here, and we'd just like to have the PUC be able to study the impact on it and kind of back that up. I would ask if the author would kind of accept this as a friendly amendment.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I wouldn't accept this as a friendly amendment. I certainly do really value the mining industry, as I indicated in my earlier remarks, and I think it's important to recognize it as it is already recognized in the bill. I don't know that I would have it specifically in this section of the bill, so I would ask for a no vote.
Madam Chair, if I could ask for a roll call.
Representative Miller's asked for a roll call on A17. The author of the bill recommends a no vote, and the chair votes no.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Swazinski?
Yes.
Representative Acom?
No.
Representative Baker?
Aye.
Representative Behrman?
No.
Representative Bowe?
Yes.
Representative Christensen? Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Jordan?
No.
Representative Mahoney?
Pass.
Representative Mecklen?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Stevenson?
No.
There's 6 ayes and 8 nays, 1 abstain, and the amendment is not adopted. We have 18 before us. Is there somebody going to offer 18?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author, I hope I can, the first time ever in this biennium, hit 50% of my amendment. I'd like to push forward the A18. This amendment offers protections for the proposed Becker natural gas power plant and the state's existing nuclear plants. I hope you would find this as a kind and favorable amendment, if you would. Obviously, as we've transitioned, you know this is a big part of the community. We've had this conversation numerous times, and as we do go through this transition, the reliability going forward, I don't think we can make an all-or-one-nothing jump at one given time. So, take this into account.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I request a division between lines 1.5 and 1.6. Those are two separate provisions, and it feels divisible to me.
It is divisible, and which one do you want to vote on first, and then we'll hear from you.
The second half, 1.6 to 1.9.
We'd like to vote on lines 1.6 to 1.9 first. Would you want to say something, and then I will ask the author of the bill.
Right. I'd respectfully suggest to the author of the bill that lines 1.6 to 1.9 are worth accepting. It would apply the process if we retire a nuclear plant of looking at replacement resources that is in the rest of the bill, and that seems like a good idea.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, I agree. I think that this section of the amendment is consistent with the underlying philosophy of the bill, and so I would accept this portion of the amendment.
Members, I'm hearing some agreement here, so we will vote on right now. The 1.6 to 1.9, the author recommends a yes vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? That part of the amendment is adopted. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would respectfully suggest to the bill author that we vote down the first part of the amendment, 1.4 to 1.5. This is not a facility that has been proposed yet before the Public Utilities Commission, and I think it's appropriate for the framework in the bill to apply to new proposals for facilities.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, I think that this section of this particular project, I think the exception that is proposed here is too broad, and so I would concur with you that it should be rejected. I think, among other things, the size of the plan could be discussed at the PUC.
Representative Mecklen, did you have something?
I would like to ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested.
I get some clarification. I don't know who cares to answer this one, but is this the 750-megawatt gas power plant in St. Cloud?
In Becker.
Becker?
Yeah.
It is.
I shouldn't say the you mentioned a specific megawatt amount, and I candidly just don't know the size of it. And actually, one of the things that I think the PUC has to determine is what size would be approved. I think the legislature granted certain approvals by statute previously, but there are some questions that are left to be decided. That's why I wouldn't accept this particular amendment.
Representative Mahoney, too, Excel was here testifying about their integrated resource plan, I asked the question about whether this language requires the Public Utilities Commission to approve a gas plant, and they said no, the Public Utilities Commission still has discretion over approval of a gas plant as well. So there is discretion that the Public Utilities Commission has in this regard.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Who made the determination that the PUC still has that particular
discretion? I asked that question of the Xcel Energy planners who were testifying in front of us, and they said that was their interpretation of this.
Since when does Xcel get to make the rules?
They don't. I'm just giving you information about.
So that would be a complete false statement, or just a statement from a couple of lawyers that were talking in a coffee shop.
My real
irritation is the chair of the Energy Committee at that particular time, having seen how much building trades really wanted to do something like this and did not make the law a little bit more specific. But that would be you.
Yeah, I know who it was.
And I stepped out on a branch for you.
No, you did. Yeah.
All right. I would probably.
All right.
Thank you.
Matt, if I could just chime in for a second since my.
You got dragged in anyway.
My former self was referenced. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. Representative Mahoney, as part of the negotiation between Xcel and the Public Utilities Commission and environmental groups, they voluntarily agreed to prematurely decommission some coal resources up in Sherco. And part of that plan was to build a natural gas power plant, not only just for energy supply, but also reliability in the grid, leveraging existing transmission. And the Public Utilities Commission, in their infinite wisdom, decided they wanted to hold off on the certificate of need. So the legislature, and you're correct, in a bipartisan fashion, the House and Senate, and the governor signed into law requiring that the certificate of need be approved, which is pretty unprecedented and sent a pretty strong signal to the Public Utilities Commission that this is something they should stop screwing around with, which, of course, their response to that was to continue to screw around with it. So.
With that, members, I think we are ready to vote. And 1.5. The author of the bill recommends a no vote, and I believe we have a roll call that has been requested, and the chair votes no.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Swazensky?
Aye.
Representative Acom?
No.
Representative Baker?
Yes.
Representative Bierman?
No.
Representative Bowe?
Yes.
Representative Christensen? Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Jordan?
No.
Representative Mahoney?
Yes.
Representative Meckland?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Stevenson?
No.
Are 7 ayes, 8 nays, and the amendment is not adopted. So we are going now to a 19.
Madam Chair, I will take that one.
Representative
Cole. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, I would like to move the A-19 amendment. This will extend prevailing wages into community solar gardens, and I believe that this amendment was accepted into last year's solar gardens bill, so I would encourage acceptance of the yes vote.
Madam Chair, Representative Bowe, it wasn't just accepted, I offered it. I think it's good policy, but I don't think it belongs in this bill. I think that when we have a community solar discussion, I would support prevailing wage, but I don't think it should be in this bill. So I would ask for a no vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounded for a moment like you knew a good thing when you saw it.
Ouch.
Members, A-19 is before you. The author of the bill suggests a no vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
Not adopted. We're on A-20. Is somebody going to offer A-20?
Madam Chair, I'd like to withdraw the A-20 amendment.
A-20 has been withdrawn. Now we have A-21.
Yes, Madam Chair, the A-20 amendment, did I say A-20 or K-1? A-21 amendment, sorry, Madam Chair. This amendment includes the Senate-adopted language on the definition of carbon-free energy, the Senate carbon capture and storage technology. The Senate is receiving, I believe, a presentation about this maybe today or something like that. So it's been an active conversation in the Senate. I think they've messed around with the numbers, and I do believe it's back to where it needs to be. And I would ask for your support.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, I would oppose this amendment. It might just be because I'm a lawyer, but I think that definitions matter. And when you're saying that a carbon-free resource includes something that is 80% capture, that's not carbon free. It's by definition at least 20% same carbon impact. So I would oppose the amendment.
Members, A21 is before you. The author of the bill suggests a no vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No. No.
A21 is not adopted. Now we're going to a Bierman Amendment, which is A12.
Skipping the line.
Representative Bierman.
A12, Madam Chair, thank you very much. This is the electricity rates to be posted on the website that we heard in committee, and I would move to adopt this one into the bill as well, please.
Author of the bill?
I would accept this amendment.
Okay. A12 has been offered. I see no further discussion. All those in favor of A12 say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
Okay. A12 has been adopted. We're next at A13. And that I have for Representative Christensen.
This is so. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is House File 3101 that we passed out of committee last week, I believe. And so we made a few amendments here, more or less just reorganizing the bill and adding in some term meanings. So it doesn't change the, you know, what the bill is doing. So I'd like to move the A13 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question to the author of the amendment. Is it required that this inserts on recycled paper?
It's not in the bill, sir.
Okay. A15, oh, wait a minute. A13 is before you, members, and the author?
I would accept the amendment.
The author accepts the amendment and recommends a yes vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay.
No.
Okay. Amendment A13 is adopted. We have, I think, one more left, or do I have two?
One.
Just one. And that is A5.
I'd like to offer that, Madam Chair.
Would you like to explain the amendment?
Yep. And this bill is just, or this amendment is just kind of helping clarify what nuclear is, you know, and I guess that's being part of carbon-free, wanting to be able to utilize it into the future. And I guess just, we heard a little bit about nuclear earlier today. It's been in the Star Tribune over the weekend. And, as a path of carbon-free, I think it would be something that would be good.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative, just to be clear, this amendment repeals the moratorium on new nuclear-powered facilities in Minnesota. It actually does not add nuclear into the definition of carbon-free. I don't support the amendment. We did adopt earlier some language that clarifies about the continued operation of existing nuclear in Minnesota.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, if we're serious about carbon-free electric generation, we absolutely need to keep nuclear in the mix. The author of the bill said himself one of the reasons he didn't support our bill for carbon capture technology, 80%, is because it did release 20%. Well, I'm pretty sure that nuclear does not emit any carbon dioxide. So if that's our goal, I think we need to be looking towards making sure that we can have all opportunities to generate electricity within the state.
Members,
as an option.
A5 is before you. The author of the bill recommends a no vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
No.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Members, as far as I know, we have no other amendments before us. And so we will have discussion before Representative Stevenson renews his motion. So we have Representative Guapo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the previous discussion, I just want to make sure I had a clarification. So Representative Stevenson, Representative Long mentioned this in Section 10 of the bill, when it references the definition of clean energy resources in that section, it is your understanding or it's your intent that that definition of clean energy resources, that would use the definition that's on, that references the definition on 4.17 through 4.19. That's your intent with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. I just want to make sure. Have you gotten caught missing something earlier? I'm just double checking that. I think that's accurate, Representative Garofalo. I think that clean energy resources is a defined term under the bill on the lines that you referenced.
And Madam Chair, Representative Long, is that just to reinforce that's your belief too?
That's the way the bill's done.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, Representative Long, are you aware that you're giving preferential status to coal power carbon sequestration in North Dakota? Because that's that statute that it references.
Which statute are you referring to, Representative?
The statutory definition that's used as the basis for determining hydro. It also includes, I can read the statute to you guys, it includes carbon sequestration as well. Was that your intent?
Can you give me the statute reference?
Absolutely. So it's 216BH.01 subdivision 2. Was that the author's intent or not? 216B.
Yep.
216H.01 subdivision 2. Was it your intent to include the?
Well,
I think I can help you out with the cross references if you don't mind, Representative Garofalo. So we're referring to clean energy resources, which is the definition in 417 to 419, not 421. And so there isn't a reference to 216H.01 in Section 10.
Okay.
So
do you understand the distinction Representative Long's making there?
Between clean energy resource and carbon-free resource.
Yes.
That's what we're discussing.
You understand, do both gentlemen understand the distinction that was just made?
If you want to make your point, Representative Garofalo, I'd listen to it. I don't know what you're...
No, I'm simply asking a question. Do you understand the difference between the distinction you just made?
If your question is, do I understand the references that I'm referring you to, then yes, that's what I'm referring you to.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I'm wondering if I could just ask your indulgence. Sometimes other people say it better than we can. And there is just an absolutely wonderful less than 2 minute clip that personifies my views on energy. And I'm wondering if you could just allow me to, it's a famous person who I think you know. And it's less than 2 minutes. I think if I play it, you'll be able to hear it.
I think you're not asking my indulgence. You're asking the indulgence of the whole committee. And I'm not sure that is what the committee, can you just explain it real quickly?
Sure. Well,
as you know, with wind and solar, the renewables cost coming down, the battery costs are coming down. You think that's enough, or do you think
that is so disappointing? I mean, really. Václav yesterday, he said, okay, here's Tokyo, 27 million people. You have 3 days of a cyclone, basically, every year. It's 22 gigawatts. Rate over 3 days. You know, tell me what battery solution is going to sit there and provide that power. I mean, let's not joke around. You're multiple orders of magnitude, you know, $100 per kilowatt hour. That's nothing. That doesn't solve the reliability problem. And remember, electricity is 25% of greenhouse gas emissions. Whenever we came up with this term clean energy, I think it screwed up people's minds because they didn't, now they don't understand. I was at this conference in New York, I won't name it, and they were saying, all these financial guys got on stage and said, oh, we're going to rate companies in terms of their CO2 output. We're going to say this company puts out a lot of CO2 and financial markets are magical and all of a sudden the CO2 will stop being emitted. And I was like, okay, how do you make steel? Do you guys on Wall Street, do you have something in your desks that makes steel? What? Where's the fertilizer, cement, plastic? Where's it going to come from? You know, do planes fly through the sky because of some number you put on a spreadsheet? So the madness of this so-called finance is the solution. I just don't get that. There is no substitute for how the industrial economy runs today.
Yeah, so, Madam Chair, I appreciate your indulgence. That's, for those that didn't recognize the voice, that's Bill Gates, who, pretty smart dude, very active in the energy sphere in terms of seeking reductions in emissions, seeking solutions for the climate change crisis that's out there. I think the news in energy is really good. It's being driven by technology. It's being driven by private sector stakeholders. I think back to when we were in back in 06 and 07, when the nation's back was against the wall when it came to energy. I mean, everything we had cost tons of money. Everything polluted a lot. If we wanted new energy, we had to get it from environmentally sensitive areas. It was horrible. And now, less than 15 years later, because of a multitude of private sector and private sector solutions and innovation with very little to do with public policy, we're now seeing America become more energy independent and cleaner. This bill, the stated goals for the bill are good. I do think it's important for us to remember as we go forward that energy mandates, energy requirements are very powerful weapons. And it's important that legislators not wield that weapon around like a kid who just found their dad's gun. I think as we're going forward, you're going to see more of this discussion, more emerging technologies. I like the fact that we're having these conversations. And these things take time, Representative Stevenson. I think you're a good advocate for it. I think you got reasonable tendencies, and I look forward to you being successful someday on that. I don't think it's going to be today or this year, but I think that going forward, there's an opportunity there for us to to partner with our Canadian friends and the hydro in Canada, with the nuclear power we have in Minnesota, with new nuclear that's coming online, as well as natural gas and renewable resources to provide significant reductions. So I'm a no vote today, but I do share the spirit of the legislation. Thank you.
Representative Strzelecki. You know, Madam Chair, I appreciate this conversation tonight. That guy said exactly what I was planning on saying, but
he did
that phone. Anyway, his technology. But in all reality, the issues we're dealing with, we just came out of Commerce Committee just before this committee, and a bill we heard was a puppy mill bill, essentially. And the market is taking care of the problem, yet the legislature is stepping in to kill off the last two businesses in the state. Two or ten businesses that are still selling puppies from a crazy source, and it's 2% of the market. So, folks, Xcel Energy, a lot of the folks that are involved in this are building this technology. And if you want to make it expensive, have the legislature get involved. You look at the community solar program, you look at the rest. Let's find a very expensive way to solve a problem that's solving itself. Let a politician get involved to mess it up. And folks, this is got some legs in the Senate, parts of it and pieces of it. There's arguments to be made that we're making mistakes, and there's arguments to be made that we're doing good public policy. It's interesting. And, I think this bill potentially has some friends on both sides of the aisle, and some parts of it don't. And, I would just encourage the member, Representative Stevenson, to continue to work with members. I appreciate the inclusion of certain parts of this bill that affect parts of our state, but to really look at what we can be doing on a bipartisan way, but also a bi-state way, not just Metro and what Metro wants, about what the rest of the state would like. And I would ask for a roll call.
Representative Stevens, I don't see any other questions. I hear a roll call. Representative Stevenson renews his motion that House File 1405, as amended, be returned to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development. Would you like to make a statement before we vote?
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. I think this is a good bill that will continue to get better. You know, it has been a collaboration, and that's important because if we're going to make meaningful progress on the climate crisis, we're all going to have to work together to get there. And so we will continue to do that on this bill and continue to move forward.
Roll call has been requested. And the chair votes aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Swazanski.
No.
Representative Akam.
Yes.
Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Bierman.
Yes.
Representative Bell.
No.
Representative Christensen.
Yes.
Representative Garofalo.
No.
Representative Hornstein.
Yes.
Representative Jordan.
Yes.
Representative Mahoney. Representative Mecklen.
No.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Stevenson.
Yes.
There are 8 ayes and 6 nays. The motion prevails. Members, there is and motion prevails. There's no further business before this committee, and so we'll see you on Thursday. The committee is adjourned.
Thursday?